This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Now we are going to talk about the UN Climate Summit in Brazil and how for decades fossil fuel companies like Exxon and Chevron have used money, misinformation, lobbying, and political influence to block solutions. The UN Climate Summit is a good example of the alliance between petrostates and oil and gas companies to delay, dilute, or obstruct meaningful climate action. According to DSMOG, top oil and gas producers are using trade groups to gain access to this year's climate summit in the absence of an official U.S. delegation. ExxonMobil and Chevron, which are among the fossil fuel industry's biggest greenhouse gas emitters, have sent 13 executives to the talks, while both companies have either sponsored events or pavilions at the conference. An analysis by the Kick Big Polluters Out Coalition found that every 25th participant at the climate summit is a fossil fuel lobbyist. Jeff Dembicki's recent investigation reveals how the impacts of Exxon's climate denial campaign are still being felt across Brazil and the global south today. He's got a piece out called A Pretty Ugly History, How Exxon Exported Climate Denial to the Global South. Jeff Dembicki is global managing editor of DSMOG. That's an international journalism organization focusing on climate change. He's also author of the very important book, The Petroleum Papers, Inside the Far-Right Conspiracy to Cover Up Climate Change. And we've had Jeff on a few times to talk about that book. Hi, Jeff. Thanks so much for your continued great work, and thank you for joining us again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the show. Always a pleasure to be here.
Well, Jeff, I just wonder what your thoughts are about where we are right now, given that we just talked with ProPublica's Sharon Lerner about Trump's anti-green agenda could lead to 1.3 million more climate deaths. Frontline communities often criticized the Biden administration for not taking stronger action on climate, and they really made a difference. I mean, they got a seat at the table. And I don't know why, again, Democrats didn't talk about this, but there was an amazing initiative that would have set aside a huge chunk of money that would have gone to frontline communities. This was called Justice 40, and it required that 40% of benefits from climate and infrastructure investments go to frontline communities. As far as I know, they hardly talked about it. I don't know why. It would be great to find out one day. But can you talk about that, Jeff, just how we went from frontline communities having a seat at the table and actually saying this is good legislation to Trump now getting rid of all of it?
It is kind of a startling shift to witness in only a few years. I mean, I've made a lot of criticisms of the Biden administration, but it is true that they were making some effort to make justice central to the way that the U.S. Deals with climate change. And the Biden administration also passed the Inflation Reduction Act, which directed billions and billions of dollars towards the types of low carbon technologies and industries that we need to get out of the climate crisis. And so to go from that only a few years ago to Trump being in power, appointing a former fracking executive as head of the Department of Energy, his administration releasing reports by discredited scientists saying that humans might not be the primary cause of climate change, and then the scrapping of all of these programs, including the one you mentioned, it's a shocking shift. Mm.
And Jeff, you have looked at really the history of climate change and major oil companies like Exxon and Chevron, who spent so much money to sow doubt and ensure that action would not be taken. What really concerns you the most? Because we've had so many guests on over the years who've been ringing the alarm bells saying we've got to take action. 2035 is such a key year. And if we do not take action right now, we are really going to pay the price for generations to come. So what concerns you the most right now?
Well, what concerns me the most is that the type of climate denial and climate obstruction that you see coming out of the Trump administration and from a whole bunch of companies and their political allies is that they're basically using the same strategy and talking points that were created by Exxon and other right-wing political groups like 3 decades ago. And that was what was kind of shocking to me when I published an investigation recently on DSmog showing the origins of a playbook to obstruct the global United Nations-led climate treaty process. This strategy is not new, and over the course of 3 decades, when we should have been seeing massive reductions in global greenhouse gas emissions, we're instead seeing these same anti-climate plans and talking points resurface again.
So you report that it is now public knowledge that throughout the 90s and 2000s, as you just laid out, Exxon helped fund and lead a constellation of U.S.-based organizations that sought to discredit climate science and assure the public that it was safe to burn fossil fuels and block the United States' participation in the International Climate Treaty. You got your hands on some documents, which included copies of checks mailed to Atlas Networks for amounts ranging from $15,000 to $50,000 at that time, shown that Exxon, with the help of Atlas, was also quietly financing climate denial in developing countries. Can you first tell us who is or what is Atlas Network?
Atlas Network is a really interesting organization. It's based in the US and it's basically a coalition that includes these days more than 500 partners, think tanks, and other organizations that are devoted to a free market libertarian view of society where corporations have power and governments are shrunk to as tiny state as possible. And there are Atlas Network partners in almost every country or around the world, or a great deal of them. And the documents that DSmog obtained showed that in the late 90s, at this crucial early moment for climate diplomacy, Atlas Network pitched a plan to Exxon, this is in the documents, describing how it wanted to fly US climate change deniers down to Latin America, translate climate denial pamphlets from English into Spanish, Portuguese, Chinese, and other languages, and basically the facilitate the sort of anti-climate, climate disinformation campaign that Exxon had helped lead in the United States, except basically make it global and bring it all over the global South. And in the documents, Exxon acknowledges the receipt of this strategy plan, and then agrees to fund it and sends checks to Atlas Network so it can be deployed.
You actually spoke with Atlas Network spokesperson Adam Weinberg, who said these questions deal with memos and materials drafted by former employees from more than a quarter century ago, addressed to a corporation that was never an important donor to our organization, and which indeed has not been a donor at all for close to 2 decades. Tell us more about that discussion.
Yeah, we corresponded over email, and the Atlas Network spokesperson is basically saying, yeah, these documents that you have, we acknowledge that they are legitimate and real, but this was just a really tiny part of what Atlas was doing, and Exxon was not a very important donor. And what I would say in response to that is that When I spoke to people, climate experts, about the documents, they said that the actions that Exxon and Atlas Network undertook in the late 1990s are actually extremely relevant to where the world finds itself today in terms of climate change, because over 50% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since 1751 have been released just since the early 90s, a fact that never ceases to astound me. And in the documents themselves that DSMOG reviewed and that I reported on in the story, Atlas Network frequently refers to Exxon as an important donor and often gives credit to Exxon for financing a lot of these climate denial schemes all over the global South.
Let's repeat what you just mentioned there, Jeff. And can you tell us how we know this? Over 50% of the world's greenhouse gas emissions since 1751 have been released since the early 90s. That is just striking to think about. How do we know that?
I mean, that's just based on the calculations of very esteemed climate scientists. And this is sort of a fact that's kind of like widely known among climate experts and people who make climate policy. But I think it's also a fact that that should be more widely known. And it's something actually that I had forgotten about until I was doing the research for this story. And what it really says to me is that we had this moment in the 90s when climate change was first really coming to the public's attention in a big way, and there was political will to do something about it. And the emissions cuts we could have made at the time would have put us in a way, way better position now to be dealing with the crisis. But instead, due to the likes of Exxon and other fossil fuel producers, along with their political allies, including Atlas Network, we kind of blew that chance, and now we're living with an increasingly escalating and dangerous crisis.
Jeff Dembicki is Global Managing Editor of DSMOG. This is an independent journalism outlet focusing on the climate crisis. Jeff wrote such an important book, The Petroleum Papers, Inside the Far-Right Conspiracy to Cover Up Climate Change. We had Jeff on a number of times to talk about that book. You can find our interview at KALW.org, click news and your call. Let's hear from a caller. Let's go to David in Berkeley. Hi, David. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me on. I thought I'd just add a little light to what a lot of these conversations are seemingly dark. The coverage for the COP30 by Amy Goodwin on Democracy Now! Can always be seen, replayed. Amy had interviewed Ecuadorian delegates that pointed out that the Ecuadorian commons voted against exporting oil to California, of which apparently I wasn't aware at that time until her foot on the ground reporting from COP30, that we in California taken 45% of the oil from four countries in South America. And one of the more prominent is Ecuador. And they voted against exporting oil to us. And they're sending delegates here to talk to our Senate about getting some calmness and getting more fannies in electric cars and getting away from fossil fuels. So I hope people will keep optimistic. And, our 34 felony convicted president won't be around forever.
Well, you bring up such a good point, David. Thank you so much for bringing this up. I was noticing that California Governor Gavin Newsom made a lot of headlines. He went to the climate conference in Brazil. He was in the Amazon. He was meeting with indigenous people. And we definitely will do a show about that and then what is really happening here with the climate in California, with the Democrats in Sacramento having a supermajority. What is their climate policy? What bills passed and what bills didn't pass? So we're going to do a show about that. I'm also glad that you gave a shout out to Democracy Now! Because they're doing great coverage from COP. And I want to play a clip Amy Goodman interviewed Sudanese researcher Lina Yesen about the climate talks. And she also talked about what's happening in Sudan. But this particular clip is really talking about what countries that emit the most owe to the countries that emit the least.
So I'm here because, like you mentioned, the least developed countries is a group of 44 countries. Those countries contributed the very least to the climate crisis. Their cumulative emissions amounts to less than 1%. Yet those countries amounting to over 1 billion persons are suffering the worst of the climate crisis. They are the countries that have the least amount of resources to respond to the climate crisis, including my country, Sudan. So I'm here because we are supporting these countries in the negotiations to come up with outcomes that don't just sound great, but actually work on the ground. My focus is on adaptation, and adaptation negotiations are incredibly important because adaptation is as simple as farmers knowing how to deal with the unpredictable rainfall and the crop failure. It's as simple as communities needing to rebuild after a flood or after a cyclone. It's as simple as hospitals being able to function when the storm has cut off the electricity, when they have to deal with a cholera outbreak, malaria outbreak. Adaptation is incredibly practical. It is water, it is housing, it is basic human safety.
And how can other countries help with that? What does Sudan need, for example?
The LDCs in Sudan need finance. Unfortunately, adaptation cannot work if there's no money on the ground to actually finance it. And adaptation is fundamentally a public good. Building infrastructure, investing in infrastructure so that countries can survive floods, cyclones, hurricanes, has to come from public finance. And right now, unfortunately, the finance conversation is the most uncomfortable conversation to have in this space. The UNEP gap report, the 2025 gap report, has said that in order to actually finance adaptation properly, we need $310 billion per year for developing countries. Right now, developing countries are getting $26 billion.
So you might have people in the United States saying, okay, Sudan's suffering as are other least developed countries. It's not our fault. We need money in the United States. Why should we give money to other countries? Can you talk about the responsibility of the most polluting countries?
Yes, and we can go back all the way to the Industrial Revolution, where many developed countries and wealthy countries have benefited from the exploitation of coal and fossil fuels and have built and established themselves as wealthy countries, whilst other countries did not have that chance. So now we find ourselves in a predicament because we need to stop emitting carbon emissions, and we need to stop responding to the crisis. But countries like my country need to develop. So there is an element of justice and fairness where we need to be able to support those countries because right now their development is far behind the rest of the world, and they need to be included in this conversation. So another reason is climate change doesn't know border. What's happening in my country, what's happening in other countries, will eventually get to other countries. It's a collective responsibility, and we need to remember that climate change touches us all.
Thanks to Democracy Now! For their coverage at COP and that clip from Sudanese researcher Lina Yesen. In our remaining 2 minutes, Jeff, what really strikes you about this year's COP? We just talked about the analysis by the Kick Big Polluters Out Coalition. They found that every 25th participant at the summit is a fossil fuel lobbyist, but that should not overshadow the fact that so many people from the global south and indigenous people in Brazil at many times actually shut the conference down because they really want a seat at the table and they want their voices to be heard and they want to say, we need action. We needed action yesterday. So what strikes you the most about the conference? We have about a minute left.
Well, I would also point out, my colleagues at DSMOG who are on the ground at COP30, they did a really amazing delegates analysis showing that in addition to the fossil fuel presence, more than 300 lobbyists for industrial agriculture were at COP30, a very large number that's bigger than some countries' entire delegations. But what these huge numbers of industry lobbyists at COP30 say to me is that they realize that really transformative global climate solutions are gonna come from the global south. They're gonna come from countries like Brazil, and they're really going to be put forward and developed from the types of indigenous communities and movements that are protesting the talks. And so in some sense, having all of the lobbyists there is depressing, but it also shows that they see there's a serious threat to their business models, and they want to try to get ahead of it.
Jeff Dembicki is Global Managing Editor at DSmog and author of the book, The Petroleum Papers, Inside the Far-Right Conspiracy to Cover Up Climate Change. Thank you so much for your work, Jeff, and we'd love to have you back soon.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
And before we end today's show, we wanted to let you know about a three-day protest that is happening in D.C. On Veterans Day last week, we had a number of veterans on. Some of these veterans are protesting 24/7 at Union Station in Washington, D.C. It's just not getting much media attention. So we wanted to tell you about today's Remove the Regime protests. Michael Fanone is helping to organize those protests. You might remember him on January 6th. He self-deployed to the Capitol when he heard radio calls for assistance. At that time, he was a police officer with the Metropolitan Department for the District of Columbia. He was violently assaulted. He was nearly killed by rioters. They were all pardoned by Donald Trump. Fanone was a police officer for 20 years. He said he voted for Trump in 2016. He's now doing everything in his power to get Trump impeached. So today, veterans, artists, pastors, farmers, they're lobbying members of Congress in D.C. to impeach and remove Trump from office. And then the main rally is going to happen on Saturday at the Lincoln Memorial at noon. The organizers say, quote, "We will no longer tolerate inaction or delay from elected officials as Donald Trump commits actual treason. We're calling out their complicity in the sabotage of American democracy unless they honor their oath. We are demanding impeachment and removal, and we're demanding it now." And here is Michael Fanone talking about the actions over the next 3 days.
Well, first, I hope to see a large turnout. I mean, I think that a big part of this is trying to create something similar to what we all saw and witnessed with No Kings, but in a centralized location. And different from No Kings, we also have a demand. And that demand is the impeachment and removal of Donald Trump and his administration, which is arguably the most corrupt and lawless administration of our time. Listen, I for those that might be fence sitters on this issue, I would say that Donald Trump was impeached the first time for less, and Bill Clinton was certainly impeached for demonstrably less conduct than what we've witnessed now in the first 10, 11 months of this administration. But yes, I mean, the point is to get all of these lawmakers on the record as to whether you are with us or whether you are against us. I say to people, I don't believe that we are going to have free and fair elections come 2026. So this kind of spineless DNC tactic within the establishment Democrat Party of, well, let's just wait and let this administration essentially destroy its support with the American people. Well, it's already done that. And they consistently double down on the lawlessness and on the cruelty and the corruption, because they have absolutely no intention of relinquishing power, regardless of what happens in 2026 or 2028. And so the time to act is now.
That is Michael Fanone. You might remember him. He got a lot of media attention after January 6th. He decided to self-deploy to the Capitol when he heard radio calls for assistance. He was violently assaulted. He actually screamed, "I have kids." And that's when someone grabbed him and took him out of the crowd. And that's when he finally got the medical attention that he needed. Fanone was a police officer for 20 years. He said he voted for Trump when he ran in 2016. And Fanone is now doing everything in his power to get Trump impeached. Michael Fanone is helping to organize today's Remove the Regime protests. Today, veterans and so many others are lobbying members of Congress. They're going to be meeting tomorrow. And then on Saturday, there's a march in D.C. Remove the Regime. .com is the website for that. We just wanted to let you know because these actions are just not getting that much media attention, and we will continue to cover these protests. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call.